I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Thomas Jefferson led a public life as the nation's third president and principal author of the Declaration of Independence, but he kept his religious beliefs private. After leaving office, he assembled excerpts from the four Gospels of the New Testament into a book he entitled The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Jefferson was 77 when he completed the book, but few people knew about it, and it came to be known as the Jefferson Bible. After an extensive restoration, the Smithsonian recently published a version of the book for the general public. It's for the first time in color and its full form. We'll hear from a Smithsonian curator about the book and what happens when an evangelical, a Unitarian, and a scholar walk into a radio studio. That's the discussion about Jefferson's Bible coming up in the second half of the show, ahead on Intersection. Here to talk about Jefferson's Bible and its restoration is Smithsonian Institution curator Barbara Clark Smith. Good to speak with you, Barbara.
Great to be here.
So this book is, when you say it's a replica, it really is a recreation of the individual cutouts that Thomas Jefferson took from numerous Bibles and pasted into a red leather volume and had bound together and was keeping for his own personal study of the life of Jesus. The book ends up starting with the Christmas story and the decree that all the world be taxed. So take us through this process, and how is this different from a standard Bible?
Well, this is something Jefferson did, as you mentioned, when he was 77 years old. So he was finished being president. He was in retirement. And, I like to say he invented word processing because he came up with the cut and paste. He literally cut passages of the four Gospels, and he organized them on paper so that he would have a single chronological story of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, and also include the parables, the Sermon on the Mount, and the moral teachings of Jesus. What he left out were parts that he thought were contrary to reason, and that is typical of Jefferson and his generation of Enlightenment men who judged everything by reason. And he thought the parts contrary to reason were the miracles and the virgin birth and the resurrection. So he leaves all of that out, but he keeps in the moral teachings and the story of Jesus's life.
Now, to walk us through a little bit of the history of Jefferson working on this project. We mentioned he completed when he was 77, but he had been talking with the founding fathers, Dr. Benjamin Rush and other thinkers of the time about this for quite a while.
Well, he had, because his religious beliefs were quite controversial, and he never really talked about it publicly, and he was very upset that in the election of 1800, his politics became a part of a controversy. He was attacked for not being Christian enough, or for maybe being an unbeliever altogether, or he was accused of many things in the newspaper, and he didn't answer that. But he did have these conversations with his colleagues, and Benjamin Rush was one who, from the state of Pennsylvania, and when Jefferson was vice president in the 1790s, he often had conversations with Rush, because, of course, in those days, the capital was Philadelphia, so they would sit in the evening and discuss religion. And Rush pushed Jefferson. He said, you should write this down, what you believe. And Rush was more orthodox and more religious. He was a very religious Presbyterian, but he agreed with Jefferson that Christianity should be made a little more reasonable, or that there were some things in the Bible that might not be totally reasonable. So Jefferson agreed to do something like that for Rush. And when he was president in the White House in 1803, he made his first effort, just using the English language, not English, Greek, French, and Latin, to put together the teachings of Jesus. And he called that the Philosophy of Jesus. But that book hasn't survived. We don't know what happened to that book. So he had that book for a while, and it's not till later when he's retired he can get back to the project and finish it.
Give us a sense of how controversial what he was doing actually was, especially if it got out in public, because there was a different view on how one's own personal religion should be displayed both publicly and privately then.
Well, there was, and there were some of the same controversies that politicians run into today. He felt very strongly that it wasn't the public's business, even when he was candidate for president, what he individually believed. And I think it's important to remember, Mark, that the world that Jefferson grew up in was one where the king established the religion of all the people. So if the king changed his religion, the idea was everyone would follow along and shift churches and doctrine and come over to a different religion. And that, of course, happened in Europe. And so part of the American Revolution for Jefferson was getting a secular presidency where all kinds of Americans could believe all kinds of things. You could worship any number of ways. And what the president believed was not important to the beliefs of the country at large. So he's very, very quiet about what he does. And when he makes this version of Jesus's life, this Jefferson Bible, he keeps it to himself. He uses the book himself to read at nighttime and to reflect upon before he goes to sleep, because he really is very respectful towards the moral teachings of Jesus, but he has no desire for this to be published or to tell other people what it is that he believes.
And what label do we walk away with having looked at this version of Jefferson's Bible? Is it appropriate to call him a deist? And what is that in terms of a religious philosophy for Jefferson?
I think he's certainly a deist, or deist meaning he believed in God. He believed in God the Creator, and he mentions that in the Declaration of Independence and other writings. But he doesn't think of God as intervening in human affairs on a continuing basis, which is why he's skeptical about some of the claims of miracles, like turning loaves into fishes and turning water into wine and increasing the loaves and the fishes. So he is certainly a believer in God, but he's not... He doesn't believe in the doctrine of his own day about Jesus's divinity.
And so is it appropriate then to put some label of Christian on Thomas Jefferson?
Well, I think everyone has to decide that for themselves. I'm an expert on Jefferson, but not on what makes you who is and who isn't a Christian, because I think people will disagree. But he says that he thinks he's a Christian in the only way Jesus wanted people to be Christian, which is a sincere disciple and follower of Jesus's teachings. He tries to live according to Jesus's moral teachings. He doesn't think it was important to Jesus to be seen as divine, or that he doesn't think Jesus even ever said he was divine. But so for some people, that would make Jefferson a Christian, and for some people, that doesn't make him a Christian. For some people, you have to believe he would have had to have believed in the resurrection, for example.
You know, we talk about Thomas Jefferson coming out of that age of enlightenment, and of course, along with that is understanding many languages. And in Jefferson's version of the Bible, there are clippings from the Gospels in English, French, Greek, and Latin. He spoke all these languages and felt each one communicated the Gospels in a different way. Do you think that he really felt that you were seeing a different interpretation of the same material as you move through that language progression?
He realized that as people recorded what had been, after all, only spoken, I mean, Jesus hadn't written his own teachings, but they were recorded by his disciples who may have misunderstood something, Jesus thought, and then they were made into the Bible only over time, after authoritative churches had decided which texts should go in there. So he thought through that whole process, which included language translation from original Greek, there must be maybe humans introduced errors into what had Jesus had taught. So he liked to compare the same text, and so on a single page of the book, what it'll have is the same verse, say Mark 3 or something, verse 27, 28. He might have those two verses in the Greek, the Latin, the French and the English. And, of course, most of us can't look at that and compare and understand because we can't read all four of them. But if you can read two, which in my case would be the French and the English, you can see that sometimes there are slight differences. It's impressive that he was so multilingual that he could read all these things and understand their nuances.
Truly a global individual, both in mental scope and studies. Jefferson Barber never intended for this book to be published, so why the Smithsonian undertaking it now and publishing it for public consumption?
Well, I hope that Jefferson forgives us for making it public, but we really believe it's a great national treasure. And because he was so private about his beliefs, very few of his contemporaries really knew what he believed. And it seems really exciting to me that now ordinary Americans, just all of us, we can learn more about what Jefferson believed than everyone except his very closest friends could learn at that day. And I'd like to think he would be happy for us to consider his beliefs now because he's not running for president and no one's going to judge him and say, well, he's believing the wrong thing. We might disagree with him, and I'm sure many Americans will disagree with his choices, but it's a fascinating opportunity to have access to the mind of this extraordinary American leader.
Quite a legacy, no matter how you look at it.
Extraordinary legacy.
I've been speaking with Smithsonian curator Barbara Clark Smith. She's part of the team that worked to restore and publish Thomas Jefferson's version of the Bible. Barbara, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. This has been a joy.
Coming up on Intersection, Evangelical Reverend Joel Hunter, Unitarian Reverend Kathy Schmitz, and Rollins College scholar Preston Davis discuss what the Jefferson Bible reveals about our national identity. We've got a very interesting panel of guests here to discuss Thomas Jefferson and his version of the Bible on Intersection today. I'm joined by Dr. Joel Hunter, senior pastor at Northland, a church distributed. Glad to have you here, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Kathy Schmitz, minister of First Unitarian Church of Orlando. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
And also with us is Creston Davis, professor in the Philosophy and Religion Department at Rollins College and a Thomas Jefferson scholar.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you all with us. So it seems unthinkable to consider cutting up a holy book like the Bible, let alone you picture a United States president doing it, and then you make that president Thomas Jefferson, principal author of the Declaration of Independence. It's hard to reconcile all of that together. But I wonder, in terms of matters of faith, how do those actions, actually cutting up the holy book, ring out, Reverend Hunter?
That would be problematic in our community because we have a very high view of Scripture, and Scripture says that all Scripture is God-breathed and useful for correction, reproof, training in righteousness, and so on and so forth. So just the physical act of cutting up the Bible would set off an alarm to most evangelicals these days.
And for you, Reverend Schmitz, in terms of Unitarianism, how would an action like cutting up the Bible be viewed?
Well, I think the good news is that today we could do it with the word processor rather than having to actually cut it up, and I think that would go over better with a lot of people. I think that it's always been the case in our tradition, but throughout humanity, that people are looking for the parts of Scripture that speak to them, and a search for natural religion or the religion of Jesus rather than religion about Jesus has been sort of a perennial quest. And so for us, that it's a very natural exercise for someone to go through. In one of the congregations I served, when we gave the children a book at the end of their fifth grade year of religious education classes, we actually gave them a copy of the Jefferson Bible.
And, of course, Unitarians go very far back. You've got folks like William Ellery Channing, very important in the Unitarian faith, and also further back, William Ellery, a contemporary of Jefferson himself.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, Creston Davis, what do you think in terms of the overall perspective? Seeing Thomas Jefferson do it, cutting up the Bible, does that ring true for the time period in which he lived?
Yeah, absolutely. Jefferson was a radical, and we should take the metaphor of using the razor pretty literally here, in the sense that he was looking for razor-sharp reason. as a man based out of and motivated by, mobilized by the Enlightenment and European elite cultural movement of the 18th century, and also precursoring the higher historical critical method of the scriptures in which you're looking for primarily to get to the original meaning. So Jefferson was really looking for a Jesus who could enact a devotion to an early democracy or the experiment called America.
And you talk about using that reason, as we mentioned in our previous segment, when Jefferson cut up the Bible, he didn't just do it in the English version. He actually had several different translations of the text in different languages trying to get back to what that original meaning might be. I wonder, though, having gone through that action of cutting up, taking out different parts of the Bible, specifically things like the miracles of Jesus, the virgin birth of Jesus, and the resurrection, when that's removed from the Bible and from the faith, where does that leave Christianity in terms of a faith and a doctrine, Reverend Hunter?
Well, one of the things I want to emphasize here is that this shouldn't be a reason versus faith discussion. Jefferson was not just a product of the Enlightenment, but of the French Enlightenment, which was particularly anti-church and metaphysically challenged. You know, they had their own version of what reason was, and so I want to make sure that we understand that both reason and revelation are to be respected here. But in answer to your question, if you take out the supernatural passages of the Bible, for historic Christianity, the Christianity of the creeds, the early Christianity, you're removing a great deal of the meat of how God acts, and confining God only to what man can understand. And so that just doesn't go well with us, because we want to see the bigger picture.
In terms of evangelicals?
Correct. I'm sorry. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Kathy Schmitz, in terms of how that actually leaves the faith? Do you find Christianity majorly gutted if those actions are taken out?
Well, I think that for a lot of people in my tradition, Unitarian Universalism, it actually is very helpful. They can be a stumbling block, some of the more metaphysical passages. And so they're looking for ethical Christianity, and they find that rather than theological Christianity more accessible. So, and in our history, William Ellery Channing, who you mentioned a moment ago, his famous sermon was Unitarian Christianity. He was arguing that a more human or more reasonable, and I respect Dr. Hunter's distinction that we don't want to make too big a distinction there, but that this form of Christianity is actually truer to the origins of Christianity.
Kathy Schmitz, what do you think that says in terms of Thomas Jefferson? He didn't intend this version of the Bible for publication. This was something that he kept very private and distributed only among a very intimate circle of colleagues. Of course, now we have it published recently by the Smithsonian for everybody to look at. But what does that say that he did this in private about his relationship with God, do you think? And what does that say in general in terms of one's own interpretation of that relationship with God? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think he was looking for a relationship for himself that would be authentic for himself. And this was what was necessary for him to find that relationship. And I think that's the gift that he leaves to us today, is that there are some people who would feel they needed to turn away from the teachings of Jesus or Christianity. But when they see that there's a way to look at it from as a great moral teacher, then it's still accessible to them.
And I also, Kathy. Yeah. I also like to support that and say that Jefferson really was against tyranny and despotism, and the experiment of America was, in fact, throwing. I mean, people just frankly got tired of killing each other, the Protestants and Catholics in England in the Civil War, and so, yeah.
Well, and I think where Jefferson was reacting to the Enlightenment, I think today, one of the places that it may find a role is in interfaith dialogue. As Christianity reacts to a more pluralistic society, there are things we can agree on. There's a tremendous amount we can agree on. And the ethics teachings, you know, those are pretty easy for us to find some common ground on. And then we can respect each other's metaphysical beliefs and more theological beliefs, but we can find some common ground, and that gives us a great way to work together.
Reverend Hunter, I wonder your thoughts on that personal relationship with God. If this is something Jefferson does privately, what does that say, and how does that line up with evangelical traditional beliefs? I guess?
Well, in Scripture, there's a passage that says there is no private interpretation of Scripture. And there's a difference between having a personal relationship. All people want to look into Scripture to see how it speaks to them personally, because it's a very, you know, a relationship means personal. I mean, and so there is that aspect for everyone. However, in historic Christianity, we are very careful about eisegesis, that is the putting into Scripture what you need it to say, rather than trying to take out of it what it really says. And so we're very careful about the difference between a private faith, which all of us want to have. You know, I mean, we all have our own particular needs, and we need to study Scripture in order to be guided by the Lord. But when it comes to just a personal interpretation, and that's as valid as any other interpretation, that's where my community, again, the evangelical community, would say, no, there needs to be a corporate interpretation so that we make sure that we're getting truth we don't want to hear rather than just the truth we do want to hear.
Creston Davis, do we see Jefferson's specific imprint, though, ringing through in our national identity of God? And
I think we do in three ways.
As a Christian nation?
Absolutely. I think we do in three ways. First, he was a rugged individualist, and that still runs throughout the course of American psyche to this very day. And you can see that in the 80s with Rambo and so on, this idealized individualism. But also you see a great diversity, not just in his day, but in our day. Indeed, we see far greater diversity happening today in America precisely because it was founded on secular Enlightenment principles. You're actually able to worship God freely and thus creating great diversity. The problem today is, of course, being able to talk in detail without putting your enemy in terms of a cliche or a stereotype. So talking in conversation is key. But then third and finally, Jefferson saw in Jesus an idealized citizen of American democracy. Indeed, in my book, I argue that Jefferson's Jesus turns out to be, voila, Jefferson himself.
And if you would, just give us the title of the book.
Oh, yes. It's called The Contradictions of America, A Meditation on Jefferson's Monticello.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. We're talking about Thomas Jefferson's Bible, and we are joined by a fantastic panel of Dr. Joel Hunter, senior pastor at Northland, a church distributed, Kathy Schmitz, minister of First Unitarian Church in Orlando, and Creston Davis, professor of philosophy and religion at Rollins College. And I wanted to ask you, Kathy Schmitz, talk to me a little bit about this idea of private versus public in terms of someone's beliefs. We know Jefferson wanted to keep his beliefs very private. What's your take on that? Is it okay? Does one have to profess the innermost workings of personal faith, in your view?
Well, I think we all have aspects of our faith that we keep to ourselves that are our personal faith that guide us. And I think each individual has to be responsible for their own journey in that regard. But then there are how that manifests itself in the world and how we're interacting with others, whether it's our closest loved ones or the larger community or our enemies. That becomes a matter for public discussion, is how does your private faith inform you when you move out into the world?
And Reverend Hunter, I wanted your take also.
Well, that's it. She's exactly right. I think Reverend Schmidt has a great point when she says there's a duality here. And one is, it is our personal, not only right, but privilege to have just a very personal, inexplicable, really, relationship with God. It's just that personal. But when you become a public figure, people are very curious about every aspect of who you are. And so we see these questions or this almost need to project who you hope that person is, because that's your kind of leadership, that's your kind of theology.
I wonder, Creston Davis, how do you see the role of religion in public life compared with Jefferson's time?
Yes. The role in religion here today, I think, is just as complex and a dodgy subject as it was back then, because people have so many great beliefs about what they see America as being. And oftentimes, instead of reflecting, we tend to force our own personal beliefs into the public sphere, just like in Jefferson's day, I think in our day. I mean, if you look at Mitt Romney and his Mormon faith and all the issues that he's getting into because he's Mormon and not the standard evangelical Christian of the religious right, like, say, Perry from Texas is. So, you know, you have all these mudslinging or these underhanded comments, these suspicions that go on with a public figure. And so I think the temperature of the time is very similar. It's always going to be. I think it's going to be because the very matrix and the foundation of what America is and its Enlightenment-guided idealism that that forces a kind of dualism between, on the one hand, material public faith and, on the other hand, private personal faith. And that dualism is forced down the guttural of American history. And it's a dualism we're stuck with, a contradiction that we have to continue overcoming, or I would like to propose maybe even rethinking. Throw out the Enlightenment ideal and begin anew with a post-secular kind of horizon.
Well, I think you answered what was going to be my next question. Is there any resolution to all this? And I'll get your takes too, Reverend Hunter.
Well, I love Professor Davis's idea. Let's start all over again, shall
yes.
we? That's another thing Americans do well. I do think that, of course, we are a pluralistic nation. That's our not only the wealth of our ontology as a nation. That's how we're made up. That's how we started. Albeit not as tolerant a record as we would like to believe. But having said that, the richness of this intellectual and religious culture depends on our differences, and is synergistic because of our differences. And so the resolution is, let's keep talking, and let's get new ideas from each other, and let's appreciate and respect each other's differences, because that's part of who we are.
Reverend Schmitz, your thoughts on any resolution here?
Well, I noticed that in public debate, people are always referring back to the founding fathers and claiming to know and also to oversimplify who they were. And the world was very complicated then, and it's very complicated now. And I think my hope lies in an understanding from evolutionary biology. We tend to think of biology and evolution as the survival of the fittest, and we think that means competition. But some of the best forms of evolution have happened when organisms learned how to cooperate. And it seems that we're at a point right now where we're going to destroy ourselves if we don't learn how to cooperate. So I think the big opportunity here is to come up with a new model, one that shows and celebrates our diversity and allows us to move forward with that richness instead.
That's Kathy Schmitz, minister of First Unitarian Church of Orlando. We were also joined by Dr. Joel Hunter, senior pastor at Northland, a church distributed, and Creston Davis, professor in philosophy and religion department at Rollins College and a Thomas Jefferson scholar. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. How does the Jefferson Bible inform your religious faith? Tell us about it online at Twitter or Facebook. You can also send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson. Thanks for listening.